Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Political polling done well is both science and art, quantitative by design, yet still demanding of a human touch. It often requires a lot of money as well. It's hard to resist a poll because we all want to know who's winning the horse race. But I got a bit of a bad rap in 2016 when Donald Trump unexpectedly won the White House, despite polls that suggested Hillary Clinton had the advantage. And yet it turns out a lot of those forecasts 4 years ago were pretty accurate. It's just that folks read them incorrectly. So what are the lessons for 2020 and how we can make sense of it all before casting our vote in November? This hour on Point, understanding political polling and how polls can hurt or help democracy. Joining us now from Washington is Elliot Morris. He's a data journalist at The Economist, where he helps oversee the magazine's first ever presidential forecasting model. He's also writing a book about polls and democracy slated for publication next year. Elliot Morris, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with this basic idea that polling has an important role in our democracy, but that maybe our obsession with horse race polling kind of corrupts that role. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Polls were not designed well to predict elections, and that's because their real skill is at what George Gallup called measuring the pulse of democracy. It's assessing what a representative group of all adults or an altered population that you can measure using census data think about something. And it gets really hard to predict elections because that population is different. Instead of sampling all adults or everyone over 25, whatever, 40, you have to predict behavior. You have to predict who's going to turn out to the polls. And it turns out that people are actually not great at telling you if they're going to do that. So the way that pollsters adjust their data to try to take that into account is it's frankly a lot of guesswork sometimes. And there's no secret formula. It's just noisy. It's not perfect.
Yeah, and I think the mistake we often make with these polls, I mean, this is sort of polling 101, and you hear this again and again. We put out a poll and we sort of remind people, don't forget, this is just a snapshot of the moment. It's not necessarily predictive. And one of the reasons it can't be, as you suggest, is a poll of the moment can't predict how people are going to behave, you know, a month from now or 2 months from now or 3 months from now, right?
Yeah, that's a separate issue, too. Even on election day, it's hard to figure out who's actually going to turn up to the polls, even if they tell you they're going to, and even if they tell you who they're going to vote for. It's certainly true that a month, 2 months, 92 days before an election, those errors are even larger. There's just a lot that can change.
There's a lot of polling right now, both on the state levels and the national level, that suggests Joe Biden has a big lead over President Trump. And I want to talk about how we should be thinking about those polls. But first, I'd like you to take us back to 2016 and the idea that the polls failed us, that they missed President Trump's victory. And because of that, lots of people are suspicious of polls now. Can you sort of truth squad that idea that the 2016 polls, you know, missed President Trump's victory?
Well, the reason that I think people use the word miss, or the New York Times words that data failed us in calling the election, end quote, is that they're stuck in this mindset that you and I have already discussed is wrong, that polls are hyper-predictive of election outcomes, that they can anticipate behavior within fractions of percentage points or so. And that's just not right. Like I said, there's lots of error. The true margin of error for polls is probably about twice as high as people are used to hearing, you know, so the 3-point margin of error that gets reported for a poll of like 1,000 people, it's probably more like 7 points in practice because of all this extra error, like I'm discussing, of figuring out who's actually going to vote and, you know, some other statistical quirks that we'll get into. And so once you shed that mindset the so-called failure in 2016, I think, looks a lot less like a failure and more like an above-average error in the polls, but certainly not an historically bad performance for the polls. So, you know, to throw a few numbers out here, the polls in 2016 had Hillary Clinton's margin of victory at like 3 points or so, and she won by 2 points. That's a one-point error. Historically, polls...
She won the popular vote by 2 points. Yeah, right. Exactly. Go ahead. Sorry.
That's right. And historically, the error that you would expect in national popular vote polling is about 2.5 points on average. So you can kind of construe that as a better than average performance. Now, of course, polls were worse than average in swing states, especially in the Midwest. And so they did worse than average. But this is not a 99th percentile event. You know, 538, I think, was the closest to what you can extract from polling data and giving her like a 70-75% chance. And what that means in practice is that the polls, once you account for all of this error that you and I are discussing, or maybe 538 doesn't even do a good enough job of that because there's so much extra error in the way they collect the data, and we'll talk about that too. Is that right? Once you account for the historical reliability of the data, like things can go wrong.
Yep.
And so polls just aren't perfect. That's the big takeaway.
And polls aren't perfect, but I also, it seems like a lot of people don't understand what the polls are telling them. I mean, for instance, I want to talk about that 538 number. Hillary Clinton had a 75% chance of winning at a certain point. I think a lot of people look at that number and go, oh, wow, 75%. I mean, okay, so she's going to win because, you know, she's like ahead of Trump by more than 50 points in terms of probability. But someone explained this great analogy to me that, you know, if you think of this in terms of baseball and you're down by a run and the bases are loaded and your favorite slugger comes up, you know, I'll mention David Ortiz because I'm a longtime Red Sox fan. So you've got David Ortiz at the plate, down by a run, and you think, we can win this game. We can win this game. But even David Ortiz fails, you know, 3 out of 7 times. But he can swing the bat and win the game for you. And I think that sort of gets overlooked when, you know, we say, oh, so-and-so has a 75% chance of winning. That still means the other guy can win.
So there are a couple of reasons why I don't really love the sports narratives, and it's not because they're not relatable. They clearly are. They help you put things in context, especially if you're like a David Ortiz fan. but there's probably a big problem in Americans thinking about politics as sports. This is just like a separate discussion about political psychology. We don't really want people to think of politics as teams. So that's the reason I stay away from the sports narratives. But you're right. I mean, the sports forecasts, or even if you're watching a game, you probably know kind of intrinsically in your head that like things can go wrong in the ninth inning, even the like second half of the ninth inning. And that can happen in elections too.
Right. Okay. If you don't like sports analogies, how about weather? 20% chance of rain. That doesn't mean like you should be terribly surprised if you go out and you get rained on.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Yeah. The weather one is good.
Yeah. So really interesting. So obsession with horse race polling is bad in a number of ways. And you know, as a journalist and a political reporter, I argue that it's bad for our profession because it makes us kind of lazy. It's easy to report on a horse race poll, so we spend too much time doing it instead of truth squatting what politicians are saying, instead of reporting on their records or public policy or what people need. So given that, how should we be using polls to strengthen democracy?
Well, here comes the big difference, right? And that is that most consumers of news and many political reporters think about polls in the electoral context as barometers of the horse race, right? And I think, as you mentioned, I think it's right to say that obsession over the horse race is bad. You know, I think that polls are still a better way to benchmark the horse race than talking to pundits, talking to, you know, elites on the coast. Sometimes they just don't get things right. That's probably the case in 2016 too, by the way. Like, polls were wrong, but I think pundits were perhaps even more wrong to discount Trump, especially early in the primary. But the real meat of polling is not to benchmark elections. It's to tell us what the people want. I mean, there's a very clear argument for why polling is worthwhile, and that's because it does exactly what a democratic government purports to do. It gives a voice to the people. So if pollsters can put out data that tell you who favors gay marriage in 2015, and the Supreme Court later looks at that data and says, you know, like, maybe if there's no clear constitutional claim here, then we should just let people get married. Or if pollsters put out data after school shootings that say people want to ban assault rifles, that's worthwhile for democracy. And this is entirely different than the narrative about horse race polling, or my angle here that they're not perfect. These polls that measure attitudes among all Americans, or even among registered voters, which is an identifiable population for the most part, are good. When you benchmark polls against the performance of high quality and large population government surveys, like the Census Bureau Census Population Survey or other surveys that collect sort of like arcane government data, like who owns a refrigerator or a microwave. But polls are really good. They even get that information right. People actually will tell you if they own a dishwasher, and the data that come back are really reliable. So polls as a tool for elections, not so great. Polls as a tool for democracy, I think more important than ever.
All right. Well, I want to talk about that later in the hour, about sort of how we use them to further democracy. But with everything you've said in mind, how should we be thinking as we move toward a break here in a smart and useful way about current polling on the presidential election that shows Biden with a significant advantage?
You should look at Biden's margin in the polls, whatever it might be. It's close to 9 points in our forecasting model. Our polling aggregate lower in other aggregates, higher in others. As an uncertain indicator, the polls that get ingested by sites like Real Clear Politics and 538 are themselves imperfect readings. And when you aggregate polls, you're not getting rid of that uncertainty. You're just averaging over it. You know, by definition. So. All these averages, I think, should have margins of error around them, too, just like a typical poll does. And you don't get that from a lot of them. You often don't get that in the reporting and social media usage. The averages are uncertain, too. Take a lot of this with a grain of salt. Nothing's perfect.
All right. We're talking about what we all need to understand about polling, their strengths, their weaknesses, and their role at the center of political discourse and democracy. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about polling, the polling industry, and how we can be better informed about issues and the candidates as we move toward the November general election. I'm joined by Elliot Morris. He's a data journalist at The Economist, where he helps oversee the magazine's first ever presidential forecasting model. And also joining us now from Washington is Celinda Lake. She's president of Lake Research Partners. She's one of the nation's leading Democratic pollsters. She's currently working with the Biden campaign. Celinda Lake, welcome to All On Point. It's great to have you.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you so much, Anthony.
I know you've been listening along. I'd love you to just respond to what you've heard Elliot talking about, particularly in about 2016 and lessons learned from that experience.
Oh, wow. Well, Elliot, I want to tell you, I think you should be mandatory listening for everyone. I want to take you. I'm going to record this and just play this for the next 1,000 times I'm asked this question. I couldn't a second more your analysis, and I thought it was so, so good. I would add a couple of, I would just underscore a couple of things that Elliot said. One is that one of the key variables, and it's going to be really in play in the 2020 elections, is trying to figure out who the heck is going to turn out to vote and whose ballot is going to be counted. So this is something that drives the pollsters absolutely crazy, because particularly as it's been harder to get people on the phone or online, we have to make estimates of what the electorate is going to look like. And if that if those estimates aren't right, then we have, then the numbers will be off. So that's a huge variable. And it was part of the explanation for when some of the state polls were wrong in 2016. And I agree with Elliot, the polls were less wrong than people think, and the polls were being used for the wrong purpose. So I really agree with him on that. The second thing I would say is there are a lot of factors in terms of non-response and also some hidden Trump vote. And the pollsters are divided on this question. But one of the things we're not divided on is analyzing it and being more careful about the analysis. So all of us pay a lot more attention now to non-response. Who are the people that refuse to do polls? Mm-hmm. Are they as the people who agree to do them? Once they find out there's a ballot question, do the Trump voters exit more than the Biden voters? And, you know, who breaks off, who quits, who doesn't agree to do the interview to begin with? And we have ways of analyzing that now and trying to correct for that. And there was in 2016 some greater non-response among Trump voters. And then the other thing...
Well, let me just stop you there, Celinda, just so that I understand what that means, to be absolutely clear. So non-response voters among Trump supporters. So these are... This explains in part this hidden Trump vote. Is that correct?
Yeah. The appearance, yes, it's not actually a hidden vote in that sense. It's due to non-response. But if you don't correct for it, then the fact that Hillary Clinton voters were more likely to do an interview than Donald Trump voters.
Oh, I see.
So that if you didn't correct for that, then you were going to underestimate Donald Trump's support. And then finally, and we saw this actually in 2008 as well, people will sometimes adjust their answers depending on who they're thinking they're talking to. One of the things that was really interesting in 2016 was online polls had more Trump support than phone polls. Now, it should have been the opposite, because online polls tend to have a little bit more bias toward more college-educated voters, and they were less likely to support Donald Trump. And it is our view as a firm that some of that came from the fact that people were more honest online when they weren't actually talking to an interviewer who they thought might be supportive of Hillary Clinton.
That's really interesting. One of the things that I'm struck by, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, is sort of the divergence between sort of polling national sentiment and then doing state-by-state polling to understand sort of where the Electoral College is going to end up, or where the Electoral College is right now. So, for instance, in 2000 and in 2016, national polling seemed to correctly identify who Americans preferred. Al Gore in 2000, Hillary Clinton in 2016. But predicting the Electoral College was a whole different matter. Go ahead.
Well, there is just it's where some of these problems of turnout get accentuated, is when you're not looking at the overall numbers. We're just roaring out of California and roaring out of New York, put you ahead in the popular vote, but underestimating what's going to happen in the turnout in a Michigan or a Wisconsin means that you can win the popular vote, but still lose the Electoral College vote.
Right.
And have idiosyncrasies like Maine dividing their vote by congressional district, Nebraska, the same thing. So it really is state polling. And frankly, it's why when you're on these campaigns, they don't rely very much on national polling and very rarely do national polling, even though that's what's reported in the media all the time. What the campaigns do is state polling, or they may collect all of the states together and do a state battleground poll. But I can't even remember the last national poll that the Biden team has done, for example. I don't think we've done one.
Interesting. So, Elliot, let me come back to you on this, because one of the questions I'd like to ask in terms of comparing where we are now with 2016, if I have it correctly, one of the things that went wrong for polling in 2016 is in some of the state polling, particularly in the upper Midwest. They sort of didn't catch the number of undecided voters that swung to Donald Trump at the very end, that swung to Donald Trump late. But now I'm looking at your analysis at the Economist. I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics polling average. And there seems to still be a lot of focus on state-by-state polling. So has it gotten better? Are we in a better place now in terms of understanding with a little more precision and accuracy what's happening state-by-state than we were in 2016?
So before I answer if they're better now, I guess I should just explain briefly what went wrong. One thing, like you said, is that there were a bunch of late deciders, especially in the upper Midwest. I've talked to pollsters from Wisconsin who basically say unless they had been polling up to Election Day or the day before, they would not have been able to catch Trump winning, even with all of the right statistical adjustments to the poll, like making sure there are enough non-college educated white voters in it, which a couple of good pollsters there did, but not all of them. And that's just because there were a lot of undecided voters and they leaned toward Trump. Now, it was hard to pick up that leaning toward Trump beforehand because they didn't like him, but it seems like they just didn't like Hillary Clinton more, and they were predisposed to voting for, I guess, what they might call the lesser of two evils. Like I said, polls needed to have the right balance of non-college educated white and educated white voters and, of course, non-white voters, too, with their education split. And lots of them didn't do that. So the last poll from the University of New Hampshire, I believe, had Clinton up 10 points in New Hampshire, and she won by one. Mm-hmm. And they said afterward, if they had weighted the sample by education, they would have had her up two. So there are some cases when using the right weighting variables would have helped, but it's not the whole enchilada, so to speak. There are just some things that polls aren't designed to do well, and it's to... One of those things is to predict movement in the race after you take the poll. So if you take a poll 2 weeks in advance, then you're not going to get Trump winning. And then finally, like Selena just said, the likely voter filters in some of those battleground states were just off because they were calibrated incorrectly. The estimates of the likely voter population in Michigan and Wisconsin, many of them were based off of the census data of who turned out in 2012 and 2008, which turned out to be a lot more black voters than turned out last time, or fewer non-college educated whites than turned out in 2016. So if you have the wrong sample population and you're not waiting on the right variable and you stop doing your poll 2 weeks in advance, you're just going to miss Trump winning. And these are some things that are easy to fix. But if your philosophy as a pollster, and I think it's a very valid one, is that you're supposed to measure the sentiment of the people and you're supposed to provide information about the horse race without predicting what's going to happen on election day, just, to help other people calibrate their news coverage or to help the people understand the contours of the election, then it's totally legitimate to stop polling 2 weeks before an election. It's not a pollster's job to predict the outcome.
Right.
And I think people can take that to heart. So sorry to answer your original question. So yes, it does seem like pollsters have made some progress in 2020. Frankly, the pollsters who care about their estimates being weighted incorrectly by now have changed that, and the ones who don't care probably aren't going to, either because they don't have enough resources to do so or they don't think that it matters. And there are some you know, there are some valid objections to not doing this, but by and large, I think not weighing on education, for example, is a disqualifying error in polling, and that if you're not doing it, you just like should not listen to that pollster. There's also been a bit of reconsideration over how to predict the likely voter frame, but it's an inexact science, so we shouldn't expect that to be perfect either. And then finally, on that third error on polling and in the final weeks of the race, like I said, there are just legitimate objections to doing that. So if a pollster isn't releasing something the final 2 weeks of a race, you should on election day, you should count that with a grain of salt.
All right. I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now from Washington is Nathan Gonzalez. He's editor and publisher of Inside Elections, which provides nonpartisan analysis of campaigns for Senate, House, governor, and president. Nathan Gonzalez, good to have you on point. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I'd love to ask you just a general question. The importance of polls to you. How do you think about using them and their value?
Well, they're extremely important, particularly when we get in the final months of a campaign. You know, at Inside Elections, what we're trying to do is identify what are the most competitive races in the country and try and figure out which candidate's going to win and which party is going to be in the majority and thus what that might look like for lawmaking in the next Congress. And over the for the first year and a half of an election cycle, you kind of build scenarios about what you think might happen based on past election results, strength of the candidates, strength of the incumbent, national political environment. But when we get to this point, it's all about the data. It's all about, it doesn't matter what I thought might happen. You know, let's try to, you know, get as many data points as possible, get as much polling as possible, and try and figure out what's going to happen in the future. And one thing that we do that might be a little bit different is that I want to see as much data as possible, meaning public data, private data, partisan data, nonpartisan data. And I think I think Celinda will agree with me on this, that I think there is value in partisan data, that too often partisan polling just gets dismissed as biased. But we have to remember that particularly for candidates and for campaign committees and these big outside groups, they need accurate data in order to make millions of dollars worth of strategic decisions. They're trying to decide where are their campaign ads going to go, what is going to be in those campaign ads, which brings up a point that Elliot was talking about what issues do voters care about. And so I don't mind the partisan data. We should, you know, you should be skeptical and have a good lens with which to look at it, but I'm all in favor of let's get as much data as possible.
Celinda, on that point, can you explain sort of the difference? I mean, is there a difference if you're doing polling, for example, for Joe Biden? Are you going to be doing it differently than, the UNH Survey Center, for example, who will be doing a poll? I mean, is that where the issue of partisan data comes into this?
Well, actually, I really agree on partisan data, in the sense that what people don't realize is I have to be more accurate than UNH. If UNH has a poll that's off, they still get to do polling. If I tell Joe Biden he's going to win and he loses, he might be mad at me if I tell him he loses it. I couldn't figure it out. But I lose my job if I tell him he's going to win and he can't. And he loses. So the repercussions of getting it wrong are actually stronger against the partisan pollsters than they are the nonpartisan pollsters. And what's really interesting is that the Democrats and the Republican pollsters often work together. Like, in fact, we're about to release on Monday the GW Battleground Survey. And what that is a poll that we've done for 20 years with the Terrence Group. And we compare notes with each other. If we're coming to different conclusions, we'll sit down behind closed doors and say, what were you seeing or what turnout model did you have? Because we're unnerved if we have different results. So actually, the checks and balances on the partisan pollsters and the repercussions for being wrong are far greater. We have no incentive. Because we have the ultimate accountability in terms of elections. So we have no incentive to be wrong. The difference is 85% of the data that the partisan pollsters do, no one ever sees it publicly. It isn't released. And so that is the difference, I think, that it gives people a distorted view of the partisan polling.
really interesting. Let's go to the calls. I think we're short on time. We're coming up on a break, so we're going to hold off on the calls. I want to bring you back into this, Elliot Morris, and just ask you a question about where you think. How should we be thinking now about these Biden-Trump polls, which show Biden with such a significant advantage? What's the caution you would offer?
The caution, I think, primarily is that there's a lot of time left. Yeah. Now, Biden is up by a pretty large amount. I mean, more than Clinton or Obama in the two terms that he won in 2008 and 2012. So, you know, our expectation should be that he's favored, at least. Our model is a bit rosier than, I think, other models, and, you know, we've gotten some flack for that. But he looks on track to win, but that's no guarantee. Really, it's not a guarantee.
All right. We're talking about political polling, what it is, what it isn't, and how the best ones are conducted. A lot more, including listener calls, when we return. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about polling. We're taking your questions. With me is Elliot Morris, data journalist at The Economist, Linda Lake, president of Lake Research Partners, a national public opinion and political strategy research firm, and Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections, which provides nonpartisan analysis of campaigns, of political campaigns. Let's go to the calls. Fred is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Fred, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hello. I just wondered to what extent you thought that polling might create a confirmation bias, in that if people have a feeling or a tendency and they see that 47% of people feel that way, it tends to reinforce those opinions rather than get them to think about it. I'm not talking about push polling, which is clearly a different operation. I'm just talking about people's natural tendency to want to feel part of a group, and you're giving them a group to be part of.
That's a great question. What do you think, Elliot Morris? Let me start with you on that.
I think we should really bring Celinda on here, actually. Let's ask her first.
Celinda, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Elliot. I think it's a really good point, and I think it works in a lot of different ways. I think there's confirmation bias among elites sometimes, so that if you are one partisan pollster, like in 2004, we were warning that we were going to lose Ohio, and every other poll had the Democrats winning Ohio. We kept year often that, you know, elites will join together in confirmation bias. I think there's certainly less confirmation bias, but more peer pressure. And we're actually trying to use that in persuasion and saying everybody in your neighborhood is voting. You should vote too. And then thirdly, I think in terms of public policy, and there's a lot of, we're talking about horse race polling here, but like in our firm, two-thirds of our work is for advocacy and public policy. And clearly there, what we're trying to show is that things are changing. The voters are ahead of the elites often, and to create momentum to say, particularly women voters often feel isolated in their opinions and less confident of them. And to encourage them to say, no, there's a big group of people who agree with you. Let's move. Let's try to get this policy change. So I think it works. A lot of different things are called confirmation bias, but I think those phenomena exist out there. Absolutely.
So, Linda, I want to follow up on that great question from our caller. And I don't know if this is considered part of confirmation bias, but it seems related. Evidence that when the public is told that a candidate is extremely likely to win, some people may be less likely to vote. I know there was talk about that in 2016, when it was believed that Hillary Clinton, by a lot of people, believed that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And that may have compelled people to stay home or not, or people weren't as eager to get to the polls because of that. Because, well, she's going to win, so I don't really need to do it.
Yeah. There's some evidence of that. There's some evidence of the reverse, that actually people like to join the winner. So I think it's a mixed bag. Where I really worry about it, or where I've really seen it, is on initiatives. Because initiatives often mobilize issue-oriented voters. This is where you can vote on an issue question. Not all states have it, but like legalizing marijuana, for example. And they can have an impact on turnout and showing that they're winning or they have a chance of winning. But usually, or that it's close and you can make the difference. To have that impact, though, you usually have to couple it with data, not just that it's close, but you're part of a group. Like there are 150,000 millennial voters in this state, and together we can take this initiative over the top. So you have to couple the close results with some sense of you have the clout to make a difference.
Let's go to
Anthony, if I could add.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that voters should remember that the presidential race is just one race that is happening. I mean, in most states or localities, there are probably at least a half a dozen other offices, if not more, that they can vote on. You know, the control of the United States Senate is up for grabs. They'll have a U.S. A House of Representatives member to vote on, a state legislature, which is important heading into a redistricting year. You know, initiatives and referendums. There are lots of other races beyond, you know, maybe you don't like Joe Biden or Donald Trump, but there are lots of other, you know, ways to have your voice heard in this election.
It's a good and really important point. Let's go to Christina, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Christina, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi. So my question was, if you're looking at partisan polling, how much stock can you really take in what how people are responding to them? I'm a Republican who recently, 2 days ago, was called by a Republican pollster. And the way that they worded all their questions towards me, I basically had to choose Biden, even though the statement that they were asking me was something I'm opposed to, because it wasn't even an accurate representation of who Biden was.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Celinda. Respond to Christina.
Really, really good point. And you're absolutely right. Now, normally, there's some confusion, I think, about canvassing and voter ID programs and polling. Like, pollsters don't introduce themselves as Democrats or Republicans. They'll say, we're Montana Opinion Poll or something like that. So that's point number one. Point number two, though, that you make is if the questions are too biased in one direction, you can get people answering or people just quitting the poll and saying, you know, this is a pro-Trump poll, I'm quitting. So that's why it's really important to keep track of the breakup. Most of the partisan pollsters that aren't push polls, and I think Nathan talked about that earlier, but the real polls that are trying to get opinion, they try to balance. They do negatives on themselves as well as negatives on their opponents, for example. Or they do different techniques to try to balance the questionnaire to avoid that. So very often what is presented as a poll is really some kind of canvas or ID operation that isn't trying to be balanced, isn't trying to get an accurate number. But you flagged a really important point.
Let's go to Chad, who's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Chad, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. So my question for the panel here is, given all the noise that can be in these polls and some of the inaccuracies that, from a methodology standpoint, we've seen, what are the national polls that you consider valid that solve for some of these weighting issues that we, as consumers of this information, should be looking at? And then just related to that, are there polls of polls or some aggregation of all the good ones, so to speak, that we should be following, as opposed to following a one-off poll from Canopy Act or from wherever else? Thank you.
It's a great question. I feel like all three of you could answer it. Nathan, do you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. Well, I think national polls can help give us an idea what the national political environment is, but I am much more interested in what is the state-specific, the district-specific polling. And the reason why I think, and because that's where the fight is, right? We have an electoral college. It's a U.S. It's a state-by-state fight for the Senate, district-by-district in the House. And the reason why I'm comfortable right now saying that, you know, I think Joe Biden has at least a narrow advantage is that we're seeing that across each, at each level, at the national level, at the state level, at the district level. And what's remarkable is that you can take President Trump's 2016 performance, and right now he's underperforming by 8 to 12 points almost across the board. Like, pick a state, pick a district. And that just kind of that confirms to me that at least right now the data are all pointing in one direction.
Mm. But aren't there times, Celinda, I'll ask you this. I mean, I take Nathan's point, of course, that the election is waged on a state by state basis because of the Electoral College. But national polls can be significant if the margin gets really big. In other words, if Joe Biden has a 10-point lead nationally, that's going to say something about how he'll perform in a state like Michigan, for example, doesn't it?
It may. It really depends. And there's actually some really interesting work that has done to look at, do states all move up and down together, mm-hmm. which if they do, like in 1992, all the states moved up and down together. So the national polls were more accurate, or are states moving in different directions? In 2016, actually, and Donald Trump is a master of this, the states were moving in different directions. So as California and New York were becoming more anti-Trump, and he didn't care about that, Michigan was seeing drop-off in turnout that was making it more pro-Trump. So states were not moving up and down together. And we actually did an analysis of markets this year, and Trump creates these micro markets where a Green Bay or a Pittsburgh may be moving differently than a Philadelphia. So it depends on whether everybody's moving up and down together or people are moving in different directions. I have to say, I'm really with Nathan. If you want to actually know what the Electoral College is going to produce, you need to look at state polls. But the problem is the variance in quality of state polls is much, much greater than the variance in quality of national polls. So it gets harder to figure out what to look at.
Now, that's a really interesting point. Elliot, before we let you go, because our time is running out, I want to talk to you just very briefly about the Economist's model right now, because right now you mentioned that it's the one that probably gives Joe Biden one of the biggest advantages. It's stating that Joe Biden is very likely to beat Donald Trump in the Electoral College. Chances of winning the Electoral College, 90%. Chances of winning the most votes, 98%. Tell us a little bit about this, how this survey is done and why you have confidence in it.
Yeah, and I'll do that by answering Chad's question and then riffing off what Celinda said. So first off, yes, there are differences in pollster quality, and if an aggregate does not take that into account, you should not pay attention to that aggregate. So the RealClearPolitics average right now has a bunch of lower quality data in it that's showing a phantom or artificial swing toward Trump, and it's basically entirely driven by the fact that there's no live phone high quality data in the average anymore. So if an aggregate doesn't take that into account, it's probably not worth watching. Now, our aggregate at The Economist does do this. This is what buttresses the overall prediction model. And so every day we are taking into account whether or not a pollster or a different mode or population of poll is leaning one way or the other above the average. And when a next poll comes out, we can make the correction for that. So if all of the online polls are overestimating Donald Trump, you know, based off of what the average is saying, then we will correct the poll. It's not a 100% correction. Like, we're still going to let the average move up and down, but, you know, it's worthwhile to make the correction. Okay. And then the way that the average works, right, is basically a middle ground between paying attention to national polls and state polls. It does both. And it thinks that states don't move by themselves, but do move in groups, like Celinda said. So the Midwest is allowed to drift up or down relative to the national environment over time. And once you make these comparisons for how the Midwest leans to the left or the right, you can actually use the national polling data because you know if Biden's up 10 based off of the other polls in the election cycle showing him up 10, and also when he's up 10 showing the Midwest up 7, then you know that he has to win the election by 3 points to win. You know, those are just right. Hypothetical numbers.
I'm afraid we've come up against the end of the hour. So I just want to thank our guests, Elliot Morris, data journalist at The Economist, Celinda Lake, president of Lake Research Partners, a national opinion and public strategy research firm, and Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections. Guests, thank you all very much for joining us today. I'm very grateful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, and listeners, I'm going to move on now to On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, who's been listening from Hanover, New Hampshire. And Jack, a lot of interesting information about polling and the way we should be thinking about it. What struck you from the last 40 minutes or so?
Well, you know, there was some discussion of the effect of polling on, its inducement of complacency. And I think that that was one of the significant, indeed historic, effects of polls in 2016. Polls predicting a Clinton win may indeed have sealed her loss. And this because of the effect of those polls on one person, Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. The night of the election, when you and I were glued to our TV set, he was in the White House theater watching a movie. So confident was he that Hillary was going to win. Someone came in and showed him some results from Florida, and according to his wife, what he said was, "Ha?" Huh? That "ha" sort of sets out there as a historic moment, because, of course, if he had thought otherwise, he would have acted more decisively on the Russia matter, on surfacing and on publicizing and on letting the voters know that Russia was not just interfering in the election, but interfering to elect Donald Trump. He didn't do that. One reason was this complacency. He said, "Huh, I don't believe it. Really? She's losing."
Yeah, really interesting. You know, Jack, one of the questions that I struggle with, and I'd love to sort of get your thoughts on this as a political reporter, I mean, we sort of alluded to this at the top of the hour. I mean, polling, it's kind of like candy. It can be like junk food. It's an easy story to do. I'm talking about the horse race polling. And I'm just wondering how you feel about the balance and how political journalists should use polling to help tell this story and to what extent they rely on it too much on horse race style polling.
Well, I think so. But bad as horse race polling can be, it's better than what pundits sort of using it make of it. The famous example is 1948. Clark Clifford showed President Harry Truman a Newsweek survey of 50 journalists. Unanimously, they said Harry Truman's going to lose. And Harry Truman's comment should bring down the ages, because it's true of pundits. He says, "I know every one of those 50 fellows, and not one of them has enough sense to pound sand into a rat hole."
All right. I think on that note, Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst, always great to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And before we go today, I want to thank On Point producer Adam Waller, who produced our show today and who sadly is moving on from On Point. Adam has been a key part of our production team. He's brought intelligence, enthusiasm, and impeccable journalistic instincts to the job, and we'll miss him. Best of luck, Adam. Stay in touch, stay well, and stay safe. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook and at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.